gives his kids one homemade gift on Christmas morning. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's, unfortunately, that's not where I am at myself. So just wanted to start with that. Second off, the irony of addressing a topic like spending less through the lens of a story about three magi who bring gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh to baby Jesus. I just want to let you know that I'm aware of this irony. And we're going to talk about it. So I want to talk about these magi, first of all. Who they are, where they came from. We're going to talk about the magi, we're going to talk about Herod quite a bit, and we're going to talk about what this story has to do with our story, and so on and so forth. But the theme for this morning is spend less. That is hopefully one of the goals, one of the things that we will take away. But there's more to it than just spending less. So the Magi, who are they? They're most likely Babylonian astrologers. Now, it doesn't say exactly where they are from. They came from the east. Most scholars believe that they came from Babylon because that is where so many of the Jews in exile ended up during the exile in Babylon, right? So the Babylonian exile happens. The Jews who had been in Israel and Jerusalem and the Palestine area scatter, but they're exiled into this empire of Babylon. And so these magi, they seem to know some stuff about the Hebrew scriptures, about the Jewish people, because they're looking for who? The king of the Jews, right? So they've had some sort of access to Hebrew people, to Jewish people. And so the thought is that they're probably Babylonian astrologers. The Talmud, which is this long commentary on the Torah, on the Old Testament, is a lot of rabbis have added to the Talmud over the years. And I'm just citing my sources in the era of fake news. B. Shab 75A is where this comes from, if you want to look it up. Forbids the Jews to have contact with the Magi and prescribe that having contact with Magi, with Babylonian astrologers, is a thing worthy of death. So that's pretty bold. I mean, if you hang out with the Magi, you're worthy of death. It's not specifically describing or subscribing the death penalty to someone who spends time with the Magi, but you are worthy of it. And the Magi were told to possess special wisdom concerning the interconnection of the stars with world events. That one was pretty obvious, right? It's kind of why they're in the story, right? It's kind of why we know about the Magi at all, because of their ability to connect the stars with world events. We have seen his star. Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We have seen his star. Now, who do they come to when they're looking for the king of the Jews? They go straight to the top. Because if a king is born, where is he going to be? In the king's palace, right? Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? So they go to the king. That king's name is Herod. I want to talk about Herod for a while, because Herod is such an important figure in the telling of the Christmas story, in particular in the Gospel of Matthew. So King Herod is a king, but he's not like the king. Okay, he's the king over his area. This is in the era of the Caesars, right? So Caesar is Lord. Caesar is like the head honcho. But underneath Caesar, who is like the universal king of all, there are smaller kings who have their own kingdoms, who are in charge of portions of the kingdom. Okay, does that make sense? So he's a king, but he's not like the top. We usually think of the king as like the very top. He's the very top in Palestine, but he's not the very top of the Roman Empire. Okay? So he's been set up by Rome to oversee Palestine. And King Herod made the most of his appointment as king. He loved luxury. He loved building. He loved size. He loved wealth. According to historical documents, he had 7 palaces larger than Caesar's palace, just in the little Palestine. In Jerusalem itself, King Herod built the temple. He rebuilt the temple after it had been destroyed. Right, King David's temple, that was this great thing that had been built many, many, many years ago, had been destroyed in the wars. And King Herod rebuilt in Jerusalem for his people whom he serves, for his constituency, a beautiful new temple, and also, of course, a beautiful palace. In the very similar architectural style as he built the temple, the palace is probably a little bit more exciting and a little bit more elaborate even than the temple. But he made sure that his people were pleased with the temple. He wanted that to be beautiful as well. He wanted to curry favor with the people who served him. He wanted them to like him. He wanted them to be afraid of him. He wanted them to obey and serve him. His largest palace, the Herodian. Notice, the Herodian is named after who? Oh, yes, that's right. The one that's named after him, which is just south of Bethlehem, like less than 10 miles south of Bethlehem, this gigantic Herodian with the king's name all over it, his crowning palace, his pride and joy. This is the pinnacle of Herod's excess, Herod's empire, of who Herod is. If you want to know what Herod is all about, visit the Herodian, and you'll find out the beautiful architecture, the gold-plated everything. That will tell you a lot about King Herod. I got so excited thinking about King Herod as I was preparing for this message this week that I decided to start reading Josephus. If you know much about early Jewish history, Josephus was this historian in the first century who wrote and recorded so much history. You know, there weren't, you know, historians at every university back in those days who wrote in books that we have available to us now. Josephus is like the guy, right? There's others, but Josephus is the guy. And then I found a chapter title in his book called The War of the Jews. And this is what the chapter title is called. Chapter titles are very long and descriptive, which I'm thankful for, because if it just said chapter 1, I would have no idea what it's about, right? Thankfully, this is the chapter title. Of the temple and cities that were built by Herod and erected from the very foundations, as also of those other edifices that were erected by him, and what magnificence he shewed to foreigners, and how fortune was in all things favorable to him. It's just a chapter title. But I thought, wow, this is probably, if Herod read this chapter title, he would probably be quite flattered by it, right? It's about, you know, the beautiful buildings that were erected by him, the edifices, and the magnificence he showed not only to his people but to foreigners. Fortune was in all things favorable to him. Herod himself was actually somewhat popular with the people, right? Because he kept things clean. He brought prosperity to Palestine, right? The economy was doing pretty well under King Herod, but underneath it was a pretty dark underbelly of despair. Because despite all of the wealth in the world, I mean, Herod was rich. 7 palaces, remember. Despite all that, this is how he behaved with his leaders. He was a paranoid tyrant. He killed 3 of his own sons for fear that, you know, paranoid, right? Paranoia that they're going to try to take over. He killed three of his sons. His favorite wife, of which he had 10, but he killed his favorite one. He honestly liked her better than all the others, and yet he was afraid she was going to double cross him. Maybe he loved her too much. Oh dear. He killed his favorite wife. He killed his mother-in-law, the mother of his favorite wife. He killed one of his high priests, one of the, you know, the high priests serving in the temple during his time. Uncles, cousins, he killed them all. No, he didn't kill everybody, but he killed many people who were close to him, people who had inside information, who had any dirt on him, right? He made sure that he stayed on top. His paranoia, his power, created this terrible cocktail of power drunk craziness. And he killed people. One of the most important reasons I'm glad I picked up Josephus and started reading it is because in book 1, chapter 14, I came across this, that Caesar and Antony, you guys heard of Caesar and Antony? Et tu, Brute? Julius Caesar, Antony. They resolved to get him made king of the Jews. That's the words used in the historical document to describe King Herod, because he was king over Palestine, and who lived there but mostly the Jewish people. So his name, King Herod's name, was King of the Jews. We see how this might be relevant to our story. The Magi come to King Herod and are looking for the king of the Jews. But they're not looking for him. They say, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? There is a baby, a child who has been born king of the Jews. We have seen it in the stars. We have come to worship him. Do these Magi not know that Herod's unofficial title is king of the Jews? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I get the sense that they probably did not know. I sense that they're just curious. Like, this king has been born. We've seen in the stars. They're not thinking about titles that King Herod might go by. Well, let's just say this may not have been the best opening line when you're talking to the king of the Jews. Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We've seen his star and we've come to worship him. There's a king of the Jews that has been born who is not you, and we have come from far away to worship him. Now, let's just say you're a paranoid tyrant egomaniac with 7 palaces and a kingdom who you're afraid is going to fall out of your fingers at any point, so you're killing everybody close to you who may have a little bit of power. How do you think you're going to feel when some people come from far away and say, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? So Herod, it says this in verse 3, when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. So he's disturbed by this turn of events, that there's a king of the Jews that has been born. And all Jerusalem with him. We know that this isn't public knowledge yet. We know that the Magi haven't, like, let everybody in all of the kingdom know that this has happened. So when it says all Israel, all Jerusalem with him, we're talking about the inside dudes, right? The religious leadership, the people that he's like, is this true? Like, what? I mean, this is the people that he's coming to and saying, what is this deal with the king of the Jews? I'm the king of the Jews. Who has been born? What is this guy talking about, right? So this is the people that Herod is consulting. They are disturbed as well. So it makes sense that Herod is disturbed, but the religious leaders are disturbed as well, that a king has been born and that some pagan philosophers from the East have come to worship him. Right, so Herod, I imagine him hearing this, where is the king of the Jews been born, burning up on the inside with rage, right? I just picture, like, just what's going on inside of him as he hears this. But just putting on the most pleasant face possible, right? So it's to not tip off that he's angry or that he's disturbed by this turn of events. And he pretends to be interested in worship. He calls him back again. Herod called the Magi secretly, verse 7. Found out from them the exact time the star appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make a careful search for the child. And as soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him. Now, even if you didn't already know the story, would you believe King Herod when he said that his intention was to go and worship a new baby who's been born king of the Jews to take his job from him when he gets older? Kind of would violate the character of King Herod, wouldn't it? If he actually decided he wanted to worship a baby. So, King Herod is disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. The religious leaders, they could be interpreted, I think, pretty easily, that they are in cahoots with this paranoid, infanticidal leader. Why do I call him infanticidal? Because he literally kills all the baby boys in Bethlehem after promising to go and worship him. Every boy age 2 and under in Bethlehem is put to death because this paranoid maniac...
Narcissistic.
...is afraid of the king of the Jews. Now... that's that story, right? This is the story that we all know, and it's not a fun part of the story to think about, right? But I think it's so important for us to see this story because who do we align ourselves with in this life? That's the question. What sort of powers or lack of power do we align ourselves with in this life? This is a living story. This is not a direct and exact parallel, but I think it is absolutely related to this theme of what Herod does when he says, oh, you want to go find this child for me? Because I would like to go worship him as well. Right? He's lying to get what he wants. He's not going to go worship him. But he says it in such a way that I'm sure is quite convincing that requires an angel to appear to the Magi to let them know how to do it. Right? Because they must have been convinced otherwise. Otherwise, this angel wouldn't have had to come to them. They would have been like, oh, this is fishy. King Herod is like wanting to know where the baby is, and I don't know. He seems a little power hungry. They don't seem suspicious at all. So he must be very charming, very convincing. But I liken it to this. When corporations and politicians say, you celebrate Christmas? Us too. I was at the Michigan State game last night and ordered a Pepsi. And I thought, how unseasonable of me, because Coca-Cola is the drink of the season, is it not?
Sorry.
They didn't have Coke there, though. They only had Pepsi.
Yep. You're right.
You celebrate Christmas? Us too. Corporations do this very, very well. And the more Christmassy the advertisement, the more bought in we are, right? Because they know us, people who believe in Christmas, and not just like presents, but like, you know, you take a beautiful commercial about this old, I saw a commercial, I can't remember what, Toyota, I think? About this beautiful old tree that fell down on mom and dad's old property, and it was like this old tree, it was their favorite tree, and this couple are just devastated by it, and then the family has a portion of the tree made into a beautiful, long kitchen table, and it still has their initials carved into it, which, how do you get the initials on the table? I have no idea, because that was like on the bark, but anyway. But, you know, the old people are, yeah, he thought that too. Yeah, you know, but, you know, they're just crying and manipulating our emotions and all that stuff. And it's great, and we like the feeling. But we have to remember that these are corporations who want our money, who are putting out these beautiful ads, right? And it's not to say that everybody in a corporation is as evil as King Herod. But let me tell you what is most important to Herod and to our corporations is increased influence and the growing $450 billion annual Christmas industrial complex. $450 billion a year. Is that a lot?
Oh yeah, just a little chunk change.
Have you ever seen that much money? $450 billion. It is estimated that we could solve the problem of global access to clean water with $10 billion.
Wow.
If we had our organization, our ducks all in a row, it is estimated that it would only take $10 billion. You know, if we organized, you know, everything was working right, and, you know, factor in, of course, there's problems with civil wars in certain communities and all these sort of problems that get in the way. But the actual process, the physical process of getting clean water to everybody would take about $10 billion. We spend $450 every year. Well, that's the most recent number. It kind of goes up every year, generally. On presents. So, just like in Herod's time, I wonder sometimes if our religious leaders are still in cahoots with the political leaders. When we find safety in coded language like Merry Christmas, as though that makes something Christian, if somebody is willing to say Merry Christmas. Are we in cahoots with political leaders when we demand to support one company over another because of some sort of a shibboleth about Christmas or about worship? Are we saying, are we buying into the corporation or the politician who says we have come? Or tell us where he is so that we can go worship him. You guys celebrate Christmas? Oh, us too. Mm-hmm. Buy our product. Vote for me. Who will find Jesus? In the Christmas story, it is pagan philosophers and despised shepherds. Again, the pagan philosophers who have come to worship the King of the Jews. Now, when they encounter the King of the Jews, are they still pagan? Was they worshiping the newborn King Jesus? I would say that they are no longer pagan, but they are worshiping the God of the universe as born in Bethlehem. Shepherds, the despised of society, the lowest of the low, the first visitors to the Holy Family after the baby is born. These are the people who find Jesus. Jesus is not found at the Herodian. He is not found at the palace in Jerusalem. He's not even found in the temple in Jerusalem. No. He's found in a barn. When I think about spending less at Christmas, I think about the whole narrative of Christmas in our world, right? And who controls the narrative? So much of it is controlled by multi-billion dollar corporations, right? And increasingly controlled by politicians who want to get votes by currying to the Christian people who love Christmas, right? Mm-hmm. There is so much manipulation around what Christmas is. And we see it, and that's fun, right? Christmas is fun. I love Christmas. I love elves and Santa and all that stuff. Because it's hokey, it's fun, it's like, gives me permission to just be goofy, wear a silly hat, right? I mean, who doesn't love that? Well, a lot of people don't love that, but I do. Figure people are like, hey, who's that tall guy anyway? That's not where it began. The Christmas happens despite all of that. So I advocate for us to spend less, not necessarily because you can't afford it, right? We often spend what we can't afford. I mean, if you're going into debt to buy Christmas presents, like if you're taking on extra consumer debt to buy Christmas presents, that's a problem, right? Just in general, that goes beyond Christmas. That's just like a debt overspending problem, right? But when I say spend less, I'm talking about subversion of the powers, the principalities and powers of this dark world, as Ephesians 6 calls. The honest gifts of the Magi legitimize gift giving. I said I would get to this eventually. They bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the newborn king. And that's not bad. They have it. They want to give of the best that they have, and they offer it. And they offer their worship and their devotion to this newborn king. Is there anything wrong with that? Absolutely not. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful act of worship. Just like when that woman breaks that expensive jar of pure nard, breaks it all over Jesus' feet and hair, and puts it on her hair and rubs his feet with it. And the disciples are like, how could you spend so much money on this? This is outlandish. Couldn't we give it to the poor? And Jesus says, no. No. She's preparing me for my burial. And whenever my story is told, her story will be told. So there is a time and a place for giving good gifts. And actually, next week's theme is give more. So can we give more while spending less?
Yes.
Maybe. You guys all agree, aren't you? So maybe you guys can help me with this sermon.
Not a problem.
There's nothing wrong with giving gifts. But, again, the caution. Politicians, advertisers, and corporations use the symbols and language of worship and Christmas to lure us into spending more. And that is a problem. If we feel like it's our duty as a Christian family to provide a certain number of gifts for our kids, that's a problem. If we feel the pressure to go into debt in order to buy whatever it is, I don't even know what the thing is this year that everybody wants. Maybe I already bought it. I really don't know. But they lure us. And I think that a way to follow Jesus, and this is the final point, a good way to follow Jesus is to follow him in subverting the empty promises of the Christmas industrial complex with simple barns and faithful presents. Again, and I say presence on purpose, not P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S, but P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E. Christmas happens in a barn just a few miles north of the Herodian and just a few miles south of the Great Jerusalem Palace. Almost equidistant from the two. That's where Bethlehem is, right in the middle. In the shadow, two enormous structures built by a wild, maniacal king. That's where Christmas happens. It's in the shadow of those things. Despite those things, despite every effort of those things to destroy that first Christmas. So when we spend less, we can say, no, I don't buy into that. That's not what Christmas is all about. It's easy to say, yeah, that's what Christmas. Christmas is not all about the $450 billion Christmas industrial complex. That's not what it's about. Right? As the Grinch says, it came without ribbons, it came without tags, it came without packages, boxes, or bags. Somehow Christmas can show up without all that stuff. Can you believe it? We know it to be true, and yet we spend more.
Sorry.
We spend more. So the call, I think, of the baby Jesus in the manger is just to spend less. I'm not going to tell you how much less. I'm not going to tell you what you can and can't spend your money on. But be mindful. Be mindful of truly what it is all about. Be mindful of the sway that the culture has over us. the sway of advertisers, the sway of all of the stuff that gets wrapped up in the, I mean, we're just trying to figure out how we can include everything in the entire economy and everything else into the concept of Christmas, right? Because Christmas has gotten so big and unwieldy. It's Frosty, it's mistletoe, it's Santa, it's an elf on a shelf that moves all around. It is Jesus. It is all of those things all wrapped up together. And it's like, how much can we fit in there? And I'll say, okay, let's acknowledge that that's true and focus in on a tiny town, a tiny barn, a nasty manger, and the shadow of two enormous palaces. The palaces are not where it's at. That's not where the action is. That's where the destruction is. That's where the hopelessness is. The hope of the world, the peace of the world, the joy of the world, the love of the gospel is in the barn. You already know that. I'm not telling you something you didn't already know, but it's true. It's true. And may it affect, may it impact the way we celebrate Christmas. May it impact the presents we put under the tree. May it impact everything about the way we spend our times in the next couple weeks as we prepare for Christmas, as we go after Christmas. May we be transformed by the manger scene, not by the gigantic gold-plated palaces. Let's pray. Gracious God, we thank you that you have given us life. That you have given us mercy and strength, healing, forgiveness. We thank you, Lord, for the simple message, the simple truth of your presence, which we celebrate at Christmas. May we be shaped in every way by what you have done for us in the simplicity and the smallness of a small town, a small barn where the light of the world entered.